my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, John T. from Spearfish, South Dakota.
Good evening, everybody. My name is John Tuple. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is the 12th August of 1985. That's by the grace of a loving God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and good sponsorship. My home group is the Northern Hills Recovery Group in Spearfish, South Dakota. It's good to be here, good to be sober today. I'd like to thank Bob for asking me to come and share tonight. Bob's an important part of my story. I'll get to some of that in recovery, in the latter part of my recovery there. I've had the privilege of being sponsored by some very top-notch sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of which has been Bob. My current sponsor, you got to hear last week. He told me that he prepped you guys for me. I don't know. So if you were here last week, I don't know if that meant he gave you a disclaimer of how sick I really am or what that means, but I'm happy to be here. I'd like to welcome the newcomers tonight to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, welcome. I hope that you're in desperate straits for your sake. That may sound cruel, but Alcoholics Anonymous works a lot better when you've run out of options and you're desperate. Because then you're more teachable than if you're just here to check us out. If you're just here to check us out, I would encourage you to give this thing a good college try for at least 6 weeks. You know, jump in the middle of this thing, get a sponsor, and do everything that guy asked him to do, that guy or gal asked you to do for 6 weeks, and then pass judgment on it, rather than judging it from the fringes. Give it a good try. I'm here to share in a general way what my life used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm also, it's very important that I share my experience about how I've developed a personal relationship with my God and the impact that's had on my life. And so I'm going to try and convey those two messages tonight and tell you a little bit about myself. I'll just start off with my childhood. I grew up on a little mountain ranch north of Deadwood, South Dakota, the younger of two kids. I have an older sister who I always had to compete with all my life, never could quite catch up with. She's a PhD chemist at the University of California at Riverside. And so she always set a high standard in our family. My dad was uneducated, a very intelligent man, but he'd grown up during the Depression without a mother, didn't have an opportunity for an education. My mother was a bookkeeper. My dad worked for many years for Homestake Mining Company, and he was disabled for many years with multiple sclerosis. His disability and the ways, or lack of ability to deal with that and the financial stress that put on my family created a lot of stress in the household growing up. My dad grew up, my grandfather was an immigrant German. He grew up around alcohol from the time he was a little kid. My dad, grandfather made home brew and moonshine. So my dad grew up drinking at an early age, and so it was only natural for him to introduce me to alcohol. My dad was not an alcoholic. My dad could control and enjoy his drinking. I only ever saw him one time drink more than two drinks. I had two brothers that had problems with alcohol, but that was not my dad's problem. But he liked to go on to the bar and have a couple drinks. And so from the time I was about 4 years old, I started going to the bar with my dad. And he'd order a whiskey and Coke, and the waitress asked me what I wanted. I remember the first time I went in there. Well, he wanted a Coke High, I wanted a Coke High. And she looked at me kind of funny and says, well, bring him a Schlitz. So I sat there and drank that High Point Schlitz, and my dad had his Coke High, and then we went off on our way to the father and son banquet at the Presbyterian Church, at my grandmother's church. And my teetotaling grandmother, his mother-in-law, I'm sure she would have just thought that was wonderful that he had done that. But those were always in controlled situations, you know, maybe have a couple beers on a haying crew when I was 14, working on farms and stuff. 4-H was an important part of my life. I had a 4-H leader that was an important mentor to me. Both my grandfathers were deceased by the time I grew up, and so I was really active in 4-H as a youth, and it was kind of an outlet for me. I got drunk the first time I was 15 years old. I had won a 4-H trip to Denver, Colorado, to the National Western 4-H Roundup. It was held in conjunction in January with the Denver Stock Show, and so I won this trip down there, and the last day that we were there, there was a couple guys from ranch country up in Harding County, north of where I lived, that were a couple years older than I was, and they got the bright idea that we ought to have a party. And so we went downtown Denver and found a guy warming himself on a ventilation grate on one of those high-rise buildings, and got him to go in and buy us two bottles of whiskey and a bottle of vodka, and we snuck it back into the seventh floor of the Executive Tower Inn in downtown Denver and got some pop out of the pop machine. And we were sitting around there that night about 8 o'clock at night in our cowboy hats, pouring ourselves mixed drinks. I was 15 at the time, and boy, we really thought we were somebody, you know. And I can remember drinking that whiskey and Coke. And I liked everything about that. I liked the taste of it, I liked the smell of it, and more than anything, I liked the effect of it, because I had drank about four of those in pretty rapid succession, and all of a sudden, I just felt like the missing ingredient in my life, like I'd been running low on oil all my life, and just kind of was overheating, and now all of a sudden, boom, I just felt alive for the first time in my life. And I wanted more of that, and it didn't take very long. There was like eight or nine of us in the room. It didn't take very long before we ran out of the whiskey. You know, most of the guys, they were talking about how they were going to go down the room and get something going with the girls, and which they never did. They did a lot of talk about that, but they didn't do anything at night, to my knowledge. I don't know. I got drunk. I don't know what they did. But there was a bottle of vodka there that nobody seemed too interested in, and so I asked somebody what to do with that, and so they said mix it with 7-Up, and I tried that, and that was hideous compared to the whiskey and Coke. I tried a second one and it wasn't any better. And I discovered that night the way that you drink vodka is you just drink it straight out of the bottle and maybe you chase it with a little water. And so while everybody else sat around that night and just socialized and was happy, I got drunk. And the last memory I have of that evening was the guy that had instigated this thing trying to get me to shut up and slugging me in the chest about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I fell over backwards and passed out on the floor. And I missed the morning breakfast. I don't know who packed my suitcase that morning. We were headed back to South Dakota, and the next memory I have is riding a Trailways bus back to South Dakota with a hangover and being, you know, lightly ridiculed by my friends, my quote-unquote friends, right under the nose of the chaperone and about the way that I had drank. And the doctor's opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about alcoholics suffer from an allergy to alcohol. We have a phenomenon of craving. I had drank beer in different situations that never really had an adverse reaction from that, but when I poured that hard liquor in my system that night, I think I had an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And it set up a craving within me that was beyond my mental control. And I think that I was the only guy in that room that had that effect, because nobody was fighting to get that bottle of vodka away from me. They were just seemed perfectly happy having one or two whiskey and Cokes. If they'd all been alcoholic, we'd have decided in that thing that we didn't have enough booze and we had to go back downtown and find us a bum to buy us some more booze, and we would have got caught in the process and shamed and ridiculed, but none of that happened. I just drank the bottle of vodka and everybody else just let me. So I decided that hard liquor was a bad thing, and so I swore off of that and I stayed away from it for a long time, but I was a regular drinker from then on until I got sober. I don't know, there was hardly a week that went by that I didn't drink something. I was a beer drinker for a long time. And that following summer, my 4-H leader died of cancer, and I was 16, and I was rebellious with my dad, and things were not good at home, and I just got a bad attitude, and I just kind of drank my way through the last 2 years of my high school career. I got out of that and graduated in 1980. I didn't really know what to do with my life, thought I wanted to be a farmer. My sister had gone to South Dakota State University, which was the land-grant institution. She had majored in chemistry there, and I went down there and majored in agriculture, for lack of a better idea. And at that time, they had a 3-2 law in South Dakota. Drinking age was 18, and it was a university of 10,000 students there. And I'll tell you what, back in those years, they put a lot of 3-2 beer away in that town. And I got drunk every Friday and Saturday night, and that was not an abnormal thing on that campus. Everybody went downtown Friday and Saturday night. It was no big deal. I didn't get a lot of trouble with the law. I didn't have a lot of those things happen to me early on. I was a good student. I could confine my drinking to Friday and Saturday night, sober up on Sunday, and then not drink during the week. And I did that for a period of time. But I was not comfortable in my skin. I had a head that was just obsessed with a lot of things. One of them was, how was I ever going to get a ranch? And it would just never leave that alone. And I just always felt insecure, inferior, less than, and just not good enough. I didn't feel like I ever had the right stuff in any situation. And the only way I could get a little relief from that little piece was to drink. And I could get a little relief from me when I drank. And as time progressed and as time went on, it took more and more alcohol for me to get less and less relief. And the fall of my sophomore year, I went to a social function on a Saturday night, made a fool out of myself. It was a, I was 19 at the time. I'd gone to this thing. It was a university 4-H function. There was like 50 people at this gal's house. She was the president of the organization. She was hosting a social function, and they had a keg of beer, you know, and everybody else is just social drinkers there, and I'm knocking down their keg beer for free, trying to just get a little peace within me so that I could feel like I fit in there. And it was really crowded in this house, and so I'm staggering my way back to the keg to get a drink one more time. And I was walking by the gal that was hosting the thing, and as I went by her, I just kind of stumbled and staggered a little bit, and I bumped into her with my shoulder, and she was having a conversation with another gal there, and I just caught her off balance, and she fell straight over backwards and hit her head on the corner of the coffee table, just split it wide open, blood everywhere. Three of her friends packed her up and rushed her off to an emergency room to get stitched up, and that was the end of the party. That was it, and I was just sitting there just appalled. I mean, if I felt inferior and less than before, I mean, I just could not get that off of my mind and get any relief from that. 2 days later, on a Monday afternoon, I had this friend of mine by the name of Tuffy S. from Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and Tuffy was an old Indian rodeo cowboy, and he was several years older than I was, and he and I were taking a range management course together, and we'd become pretty fast friends. And unbeknownst to me, Tuffy was a 4-year sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so we were sitting in the student union, and I'm telling him this gory story, you know, and he proceeds to give me his 10-minute pitch. You know, and at the end of that says, by the way, we got an open meeting on Saturday night. Would you like to go? It's like, all right, sure. Why not? I never thought any more about it. Saturday night, he calls me up. Hey, I'm going to that AA meeting tonight. Do you want to go? And I'm like, I don't want to go to no AA meeting. That's what I thought. I didn't say that. That's what I thought. It's Saturday night. Why would I want to go to an AA meeting? But I liked and respected Tuffy, and I appreciated the fact that he had called me back. And so I said, yeah, all right. So he picked me up, and he took me to this thing. And it was in a little double-wide trailer house down on the other side of the tracks there in Brookings, South Dakota. And it was a speaker meeting, much like tonight. There were three or four boobs from Watertown, South Dakota, that had come down, and they came down and shared their, much like I'm doing from the podium tonight. It was a smoking meeting. They don't have smoking meetings anymore much, but this was a smoking meeting, and there was a haze about right here. And I didn't smoke. And these people got up, and they just told these dreary tales about how they just got run. Sounded like something like this. They just got run. They really had these really crappy lives, and they were really losers, and they'd gotten run through the ringer, and they'd just gotten to the last gasp. And they, by the grace of God, they'd found this wonderful spiritual program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they just had walked hand in hand with God, and the sun always shined in their lives, and everything was wonderful, and they had wonderful families. And I just sat back there on my throne of contempt, and I thought, these people are sick. I can't believe this is hideous. I'd never seen anything like that in my life. It's kind of, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is kind of a strange outfit. It just kind of smacks of a revival meeting in a homeless shelter or something like that, you know, kind of cross-pollinated with Amway or something. And I wanted no part of it. And they got done with that thing that night, and I was kind of aloof, and all these guys were coming up trying to shake my hand and introduce themselves, and I'm like, and I'm just visiting here, you know. And so we finally got out of there after they washed the coffee cups, and I thought, geez, you know, it's 9:30. I can go to the bar. No, we had to go to the Happy Shift, where they smoked more cigarettes and drank more coffee and ate pie and ice cream and told more of these hideous stories, which they all laughed at, until 11:30 at night. Finally, my friend Tuffy took me home, and I thanked him for going to the meeting, taking me to the meeting. And I got out of the car and thought, geez, I'm never going back there again. And I didn't. I didn't go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. My drinking progressed over the next few years, though, and the next time I came in contact with Alcoholics Anonymous, it came to me. And it came to me in a form of a guy doing a 12-step service call to a jail on a Sunday morning in December of 1984. And this guy's name was Joe, and he'd been sober for 2 months, and he was on his way to the penitentiary for his third DWI, but that was just a consequence of his actions, and more than anything else, he just didn't want to drink anymore. And it seems, at least according to the police report, that night that I had, must have been in an alcoholic blackout, and I was staggering up Main Street about 1:30 in the morning where the police had driven by, and I had shared a few obscenities with them as they'd driven by and seemed to be angry about some girl jilting me or something. And so then they came to get acquainted, and I told them how I was going to beat the crap out of them and all this stuff. And so they naturally took me in. Housed me for a night in their little 4x8 isolation cell down at the police station, where I stood and screamed obscenities at the top of my lungs at them with my fist clenched around the bars for 2 hours, and got tired and woke up 5 hours later, and I had no recollection of anything. And I had to ask the jailer that morning, what? I woke up in jail. I'm like, I'm in jail. Where am I? What's this? And I asked the jailer what I was doing there, and he told me, and I couldn't believe it. And he said, well, we all got it all on tape if you'd like to hear it. And I declined that offer, but then he came back about 10 minutes later, and he said, we've decided we're going to let you go. We've got this guy from Alcoholics Anonymous we want you to talk to. I said, I don't want to talk to a guy from AA. I'm not an alcoholic. He said, all right, then, we're not going to let you go. Oh, okay, that's how it's played. So just to get out of jail, I went into the room and listened to this guy from AA for 20 minutes. So if you're new and you're kind of here against your own will, you really want to be careful to everything you listen tonight, because alcoholism is a incurable, progressive, fatal illness, and it's caught through the ears. It's a virus that's caught by listening and identifying. And so you don't want to identify with too much I have to say tonight, because I'm really a sick guy. And so you might just have to stay here if you identify with too much, so be careful. But I went into this room and I listened to this guy, and he just told me a little bit of his story, and he described to me how he felt inside. And he felt insecure and inferior and left center, and he had this head that never seemed to shut off, but he could get a little relief by drinking. And over time, he got to where he had to drink a little more and more to get less and less relief. And eventually, alcohol had become, it had been his solution, but it was creating all kinds of fringe problems in his life that he was just wasn't willing to suffer the consequences for anymore. And I just identified with this guy hook, line, and sinker, and it was just like a light bulb went on in my head. I was like, I'd been going to the campus counselors for years and different things in church, and I'd accepted Christ, and I'd done a lot of different things trying to find something to fix me. And this guy described my problem that morning. And it was like a light bulb went on in my head. My God, I'm an alcoholic. Went home and told my roommate, I'm an alcoholic, you know. So what do you do when you're an alcoholic? You go to AA, right? So I went to AA. I went to AA for 3 weeks. I went to two meetings a week. I'd sit in some little big book study with six old burnout boobs smoking cigarettes reading the big book. Boy, that'll really light your fire. And then I'd go down to the Irish shanty and drink and think about what they talked about in AA. And at the end of 3 weeks, the pixie dust hadn't been sprinkled on me. I hadn't magically gotten sober. And so I decided I was just a hopeless alcoholic, and I quit going to AA. Tried to check out a treatment center there, but I just didn't trust them people. They just wanted my money. And for the next 10 months, I drank. I was on the run. I mean, I was on the run from me. And I just drank like a crazed man, as hard and as fast as I could. And the end came for me in August of 1985. I was working for U.S. Department of Agriculture in Sturgis, South Dakota at that time. I was a student trainee for them. I was the only one they had in the state of South Dakota. All I had to do was take 14 credits and graduate and go to work for them. The problem was I had incompletes in about 10 courses because I had to write technical research papers, and I had, being a procrastinator and a perfectionist, and I tested out a freshman comp, so I didn't learn how to do that skill. And I had started piling up these research papers, and it had snowballed on me, and by August of 1985, I had 10 incompletes, six of which I needed to graduate. And I had this two-week summer course I had to take in Rapid City, and the second morning I had to go to Rapid for this course. It was about 7:30 in the morning. I'm driving down the interstate, and I had what the book describes as a moment of clarity. And what that was in the form of, for me, was, I'll clean this up a little bit. Holy crap, I got to go back to Brookings in 2 weeks. I have incompletes in 10 courses. I have 14 credits left to graduate. I'm supposed to graduate in December and go to work for Soil Conservation Service full-time in January, and I'm a drunk. What the F am I going to do? And I concluded on that little trip down the interstate, about 25 miles, that I had four options. One was to go back to school and continue drinking, and I didn't figure that was going to work. The second was to go back to school and quit drinking. I thought I had tried that the previous winter, which I really hadn't, but I thought I did. Didn't figure that was going to work. So that left me two options. One was to not go back to school that fall and drink, which that seemed like a really loser of an option, you know, after I had invested 5 years of my life in college. So I really boiled it down to where I only had one viable option. That was I needed to get sober, and I wasn't going to be able to go back to school that fall. I just needed to concentrate on getting sober. And that's what I ended up doing. I didn't get sober that day. I drank that night, and I drank the next night. In the morning of Thursday, the 8th of August, I woke up and decided this is the last day I'm going to drink. And so I woke up that morning and went to my class that day. I went to the bar that night, and I drank six Jack and Cokes. And after I had the sixth one, I decided, all right, this is it. This is my last drink. Walked out of there triumphant for over alcohol, right, you know. And I went and got in the truck and to drive home, and a bizarre, strange thing, unexpected thing happened to me. Tough guy like me. I just started to cry. I just started to sob. I drove home and I sat on the back porch of my folks' house at the ranch there, and I bet I cried for a half an hour because I was terrified and I could not imagine life without alcohol. I felt like my best friend had just died. But I didn't drink anymore that night. I went to an AA meeting on Friday night. I went to an AA meeting on Saturday night. I went to church on Sunday morning. And the following, I didn't go to an AA meeting that Sunday night, which might have been a not good judgment. But I didn't know of any Sunday night AA meetings at that time. I was brand new. And I went to my second week of this course on Monday, and I was 4 days without a drink, and I was what the book describes as restless, irritable, and discontent. I was not comfortable in my skin. And I just ground my way through that day. You know, I mean, everything was just gray, and it's just, you know, my nerves are about that frazzled, you know. And by 6 o'clock that night, I drove back to Deadwood, in my hometown, and I decided, man, if this is sobriety, screw this. They can have this crap. I don't need this. And I went to my old favorite watering hole there, the number 10 on Main Street in Deadwood, and I got drunk. And there was about 8 or 10 people in the bar that night. And I mean, I was a crazed drunk that night. Terror just gripped me. I was sitting on that bar stool pouring down whiskey as fast as they could pour it. And I was looking at myself in the mirror, and I comprehended the first half of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, sitting on that bar stool. I comprehended that I was powerless over alcohol, and there wasn't anything that I was going to do about it. Because 4 days before that, I had walked out of there, made the decision to quit drinking, as dead set determined as any decision I'd ever made in my life, and here I was. And I knew right then and there that alcohol or the devil or whatever it was had me, and there wasn't anything that I was going to do about it. I was a little too drunk to drive back to Sturgis that night. I drove to my folks' place, woke up the next morning. It was 10 minutes to 8. I was supposed to be in Rapid City, 45 miles away at 8 o'clock. I was late for where I was supposed to be. I was hungover, and I was probably, for the first time, teachable. And I said a little prayer that morning as I walking to my car. I said, God, please help me with my drink problem. And that, funny enough, turned out to be my first day of sobriety, the 13th of August, 1985. And I haven't had a drink from that day to this. Now, I'd like to be able to tell you that I was just a quick study in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, 4 or 5 months, I was back on my feet. I went to the Soil Conservation Service 2 weeks sober, and I told them my situation. I told them I couldn't go back, and I fully expected them to let me go. And they wanted to keep me in that position, so they let me work in Sturgis where I'd been there that fall, and I was going to go back in January and try and clean up the wreckage and graduate a year later. So in January, I stayed sober, I got a sponsor, went to 2 or 3 meetings a week for the first 4 months, just white-knuckled it on the third step. Then I went back to Brookings 4 months sober, and I was a neurotic mess is what I was. I was not in any condition to clean up anything. But I got a guy there by the name of Tony W. And Tony, I got him to be my sponsor, and I met with him every day. I had coffee with him every day. I went to meeting every night. Tony took me through my first, fourth, and fifth step, which was a life-changing experience. I didn't accomplish a lot in that, but I got free of one very important thing, and that was the hatred I had towards my father. And it took about a year of surrender and turning that thing over, but I got released from that, and I was able to develop a relationship with my dad from scratch in sobriety. And I had a great relationship with my dad for 13 years until his death in 2000. That was the single biggest gift Alcoholics Anonymous ever given me, other than sobriety. And that was the relationship with my father, and that was a result of doing that first, fourth, and fifth step. But April of 86, I was running out of money. I was kind of bogged down in seventh step. I was kind of disillusioned and discouraged, and an event had happened on trying to clean up one of these incompletes. I'd done about 3 weeks worth of work, fired it off to an instructor who was retired and living in Colorado, and he never got the paper, and I didn't have a copy of it. And so that work was gone, and so I ended up discouraged and broke, and I just ended up walking away from that and decided I just needed to go get a job. I moved back to Deadwood and got a job as a minimum wage guy working in a warehouse unloading semis. Got my first dose of reality and growing up there. I had about 8 months of that and decided I needed to go back to college and get a real job. Ended up in January 1987, I had a psychotic break from reality ended up in the psych ward a year and a half sober. Hauled off in a straitjacket and shackles, thrown in a rubber room, spent most of the spring 1987 in out of the nut war. That really was bottom for me. And I was sober. It was brutal. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and I had terrible mood swings. I'd go from being just manic psychotic to being suicidal, wanting to blow my brains out. And, and was really unemployable, but I had to hold a job. So for about the next 3 or 4 years, I had like 30 different labor jobs just trying to survive, because I was a loser, is what I was. I was a loser, sober loser in Alcoholics Anonymous, nutty in a fruitcake. And I went to some psychotherapy during that period of my life, and I was involved in church, and I was in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, like just a desperate, crazed man. And Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. I could not have paid the psychiatric community enough to get me through that period. And over about the next 2 or 3 years, when I was 4 years sober, I was asked to be a GSR. And I thought, you know, I haven't made a commitment to anything in a long time. And it just seemed like the thing I needed to do. I needed to make a commitment. So I made a 2-year commitment to that group that I would do that job. And at the time, I didn't even have a job. And I ended up getting a job, and I kept that commitment. And it was really kind of a turning point in my sobriety from just being, just existing, to starting to recover. I had a couple different sponsors in there. One guy helped me into an inventory. It was my third, fourth step inventory. I got into that thing, and I got bogged down in that inventory, and I'd work on it, and then I'd make a little progress on it, and I'd put it away for a month until I just get crazy and think, oh, well, maybe I ought to work on my inventory. And I'd work on that thing and work on it for 3 hours and feel great, and I'd put it away for a month. And I did that for a long time, but I finally got that thing done. And I needed to do a fifth step, and I didn't know who to do it with. And I had listened to a guy by the name of Don M. from Louisville, Kentucky. I'd listened to a tape of his. I'd made a service commitment in between thoughts of suicide. I'd made a service commitment to be the speaker chair for this convention, and I had listened to his tape as one of the tapes I was listening to, and I just identified with the guy. And he spoke about the program of recovery with such clarity that it just motivated me to take action on that fourth step. And I finally completed that thing, and then in May of 1994, I needed somebody to do a fifth step with, and I didn't know who to do it with. And so I ended up calling him up finally and asked him if I could do a fifth step with him, and he said, yeah, sure, call me back in about 2 weeks and I'll know my schedule for June and you can come down. So I ended up flying to Louisville in June of 94, and I did a fifth step with him. Actually, we did the first five steps together. And then he gave me directions. I came back to South Dakota, did 6 and 7, as he told me to do it. And then I wrote an eighth step amends list. And then I flew back to Louisville 6 weeks later, and we went over that eighth step amends list, and he gave me directions on making ninth step amends. And I came home and I started doing that. And I was 9 years sober, and that was really the first time in my sobriety where I actually did the steps 1 through 9, had guided through them, did them as they're outlined in the book, and that whole experience changed my life, and my sobriety really took off, and I started sponsoring some guys, and I got more active in service and in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ended up starting a fencing business during that period of my life, and I operated that for 4 years, did about $125,000 worth of business annually. Didn't make much money at it, but we were doing quite a bit of business, and I got involved in my community, and I ended up getting involved in Republican politics as a volunteer, ended up being the chairman of the County Republican Party for a few years there, and I ended up being the legal guardian of my second cousin. His father had died when he was 9 years old, and he had asked me about 4 years before he died if anything ever happened to him, if I would see that his son got raised, and I said I would, and so I did. And I raised that boy, my mother, with the help of my mother, from age 12 to adulthood. He's 22 years old now, and he's going to Bible College in Eugene, Oregon, and he's a good, decent, honest kid. And I don't take claim for any of that. I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to participate in his life, and at best, I was just a catalyst for him. But he's just a good kid, and he would have been a good kid, I think, no matter what. But I got my arm twisted to run for public office in the spring of 2000. I had recruited a legislator that was not doing a very good job, and we needed a replacement for him. And so some of the people that I knew in the party convinced me that I needed to run for the legislature. So I did, and I was elected. And for 4 years, from 2000 to 2004, I served as a state representative in the South Dakota legislature. The last 2 years of that, I was on the Republican leadership team, met every week with the governor, and really strategized the session with the leadership of my party. Now, I just told you that in 1987, they hauled me off on an involuntary commitment, and threw me in a straitjacket and shackles, and threw me in a rubber room. And I spent the spring of 1987 in and out of the nut ward, nutting a fruitcake. Now, 15 years later, you know, I'm in the state legislature. The road doesn't go there. You know, that's a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can remember one instance. I was sitting in our Republican caucus, and the governor had introduced a piece of legislation to change the requirements for the director of the Human Services Center. It seems for some reason it was in statute that that person had to be a medical doctor, and he wanted to put an administrative guy in that director position, so he wanted to change the statute. And the guy that's the sponsoring the bill that's from Health and Human Services Committee is pitching the bill in caucus. And I had the thought in there sitting in that caucus, you know, I bet I'm the only guy in this room that's ever been in the Human Services Center in Yankton. And I thought about sharing that with them, but I decided it wasn't the time or the place. I just kept that little piece of knowledge to myself. But, you know, that's powerful stuff, you know. I would have never gotten to that position had I set out to do that. But I had a lot of success in my sobriety there, and when I was 14, 15 years sober, I thought, you know, my life's really going place. This is, you know, hey, you know, look at me. I mean, this is, you just do it the way I've done it here, and you'll recover too, you know, and this is, you know, these are just the gifts of sobriety, you know. And I went to, I had an opportunity to make some money, and my folks had a little mountain ranch that they had sold, and I had made some money on that thing. I invested in technology stocks in 1994. And between 1994 and 2000, 1995 and 2000, I made seven figures in the stock market. And I'd like to be able to tell you that I hung on to that, but that's not my story. I had a portfolio that was worth $1.3 million in March of 2000. And August of 2000, I went to a men's retreat, and I came back from that thing thinking, you know, I think I'm just going to end for a period of spiritual growth here. I don't know what's going on, but I just felt like God was going to, I was just about to embark on a period of spiritual growth. If you ever have that feeling, brace yourself. Because I came back from that, and a week later, just on a whim, talking to my broker, I bought $400,000 worth of tech stocks on margin. And 3 weeks later, my dad passed away. He got sick on a Wednesday and died on a Sunday. And I don't know if you know what happened to technology stocks the fall of 2000, but I was losing $50,000 a day, and I kept telling my broker, I think I ought to get out. I think, this doesn't look good to me. And, I called him up one morning, and I'd been watching CNBC from 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm just glued to the, you know, it's like I'm free falling, you know. And I just called him up at 7:15 in the morning. I don't like this. I want out. I had a portfolio that was worth $850,000. To make a long story short, I finally jumped ship in February of 2001 with $87,000. And it took me 5 years to make a million. It took me 6 months to lose it. And that was some humbling, sobering experience, 15 years sober. And I'm a newly minted freshman legislator, and I had sold my fencing business, and all of a sudden I don't have a job. I needed to get a job. I couldn't go to just get an $8 an hour job as a laborer. I had all these commitments I'd made with the legislature I had to keep. And so I ended up getting in the insurance business, and I did that for 3 years. And it was just not the fit for me. And so after 3 years, I ended up getting out of that, and I ended up not running for re-election after my second term because I didn't know what I was going to do. And I found myself in a tough, tough spot in Alcoholics Anonymous, about 15, 16, 17 years sober. I was in the middle of AA. I had changed home groups in that time group. I had sobered up in, like, discussion meetings, and that was really kind of all we had there. Well, we had a guy that moved to my community from Billings, Montana, and he'd gotten sober in the recovery group. And he started a group that is structured much like this group is. And I had walked away from my home group because there was some 13th step stuff going on there that was just really a lack of integrity thing that I just couldn't overlook anymore. I ended up begrudgingly joining this group that this friend of mine started. And I made that my home group, and that's the group I'm a member of today. I'm a secretary of that group today, the Northern Hills Recovery Group. And that group has changed my life. And I ended up changing sponsors because I felt like I needed to have more structure in my life in terms of my sponsorship. And I ended up getting Clancy I for my sponsor, and I called Clancy every week at 2:30 Pacific time for 2 years. And at the end of 2 years, Clancy and I kind of mutually agreed that I was really struggling and I needed to get somebody more local, and I did that, got another guy, and that didn't seem to work out, and then I ended up asking Bob to sponsor me. And that was a tough, tough time, and there were things in my life. See, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've done the steps, and I know the book, and I've sponsored guys. I've done all this stuff, but it's very clear that there's something not working, and so I needed to find out where the holes in my program of recovery were. And so I don't know how those things are revealed to you, you know, if you're not so new in sobriety, but the way those things are revealed to me is by taking other people through the book. One of the first pieces that was revealed to me was, there's a little line in there that says, does he not suffer from the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only he could manage well? And I was about 15 years sober taking a guy through the book that, and you know, I challenged that for the first time in my sobriety, I think, because it never had really set too well with me. But I challenged that, and I thought, that's not a delusion, that's true. I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I could manage well. Now, the problem is I can't manage well. But if I could, I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world. If I could get the right combination of money, power, and prestige, people, places, and things put together, I would be happy. And I had to come to see that I suffered from a delusion that I could rest satisfaction. That's a delusion, because that's not how satisfaction and happiness is gotten. Because I've made the spiritual mistake of thinking that money, people, places, and things, situations, relationships, without sex, whatever, are going to make me happy. There is no combination of any of those things that are going to make me happy. As long as I'm looking there, it doesn't make any difference what combination I put together, I'm not going to ever be satisfied with it. It's a delusion. The way that I find satisfaction and happiness in this world is by getting the focus off of me and getting the focus out from me and trying to see how I can fit myself to be of service to God and the people about me and try and help a newcomer and get my focus off, my attention off myself and try and be a useful member of society and of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I do that, at any point in time, I will find myself spontaneously feeling satisfied, happy, and useful. But when I focus on me and what I have and I don't have and trying to arrange it to suit me, it never works. And I had to come to see with a lot of years of sobriety that I suffer from a delusion. I expect there might be a person in here or two that might be suffering from that delusion tonight and you don't even realize it. Because I, for years, didn't realize that. The second piece, after that all happened for me, you know, I mean, I felt like what that was for me, it was the last straw, because all my life I thought, you know, if I could ever get enough money to get a ranch and do some things and I had some goals, my career had gone down the drain, but I had this little nest egg of capital that I thought I could do something with. If I could do something in business, I could be somebody, you know, and all of a sudden it was gone. And it's like, I'm 40 years old, I'm not a spring chicken anymore. It's not, you know, the source of that capital isn't coming back. It's over, it's gone. And those dreams are gone. And I've screwed my life up beyond repair. This is the dialogue I'm having on going on in my head on a daily basis while I'm greeting newcomers in Alcoholics Anonymous, tell them to trust God and life will be wonderful, you know. Right. And so I was taking a couple guys through the book and we got into We Agnostics. And there's a statement in there. It says, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we can neither postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or isn't. What was our choice to be? I got to make a choice here. Am I going to choose to believe that there's an all-powerful, all-loving, creative intelligence, spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things that has me in the palm of his hands or not? And when that guy read that night in that little book study, a little voice fired off in my head that said, John, if you were to take an objective third-party look at your life today, just taking a little out-of-body look, do you look like a guy? You look like a guy who believes that there's a loving God that has you in the palm of his hand? What would that look like? Do you look like that guy? Or no, do you look like the guy that thinks he's screwed it up beyond repair? What's the use? It's hopeless. Now, which is it? Because either you believe that there's an all-powerful, all-loving God, or you believe you screwed it up beyond repair, because you can't have it both ways. The ideas are mutually exclusive. You know, by default, when you say you think you've screwed it up beyond repair, then what you're saying is that you don't believe there's an all-powerful, all-loving God. And I got confronted that night in that little book study, trying to help a new guy through the steps for the first time, with my own hypocrisy. And that was a turning point for me in that whole situation with losing that money. And I had to take another look at the third step. See, my problems weren't where I thought they were. You know, I thought, you know, I needed to redo the fourth step or I needed to work a little harder on 10, 11. No, my problems were a little more basic than that. They were in the second half of step one, step two, and step three. And I've come to believe through that experience that a lot of the problems that people struggle with in Alcoholics Anonymous are not what they think they are. They're in the second half of step one, my life is unmanageable, sober. Step two, really believing in God. And step three, unconditional surrender in every area of your life. Because, you know, I had that whole experience brought me to a point of surrender like I had never been. You know, I'd always listened to Chuck C. in the Pale Mesa Retreat. I don't know how many of you ever listened to that stuff, New Pair of Glasses, but he always talked about how he just reached a point of surrender. And I always identified, it always looked appealing to me, but I'd never quite could get there. And I just got to the end with a lot of different things in my life, the money thing, the work thing, and it brought me to a point of unconditional surrender. And I was able to take that third step in a way that I'd never taken it. And I have found, I was able to let go of the idea whether or not I ever have money. I was able to let go of the idea whether or not I ever have wealth or power, you know, and prestige and all that crap. I found out, you know, I had a little bit of money, power, and prestige, you know, 15 years over, you know, $1 million and state legislator. I mean, that just qualifies for a little bit. What I found out, you know, I always used to think, you know, people early into my sobriety would talk about, you know, if they could get happy, joyous, and free. That's what they wanted, happy, joyous, and free. And I thought, ah, screw that. You know, that's Pollyanna. You know, I want money, power, and prestige. If I have money, power, and prestige, I'll be happy, joyous, and free. And I found out the hard way that money, power, and prestige without happy, joyous, and free ain't worth a bucket of warm spit. And I had to find out that out through the school of hard knocks. And I got to tell you about that resentment. You know, I really resented that stockbroker that I had, and I wanted to kill him. You know, I wanted to kill him. Now, I wasn't going to do that because I'm not that kind of a guy, you know, but I wanted to. And I wouldn't, I guess the thing that held me back more than anything was I wouldn't do that to my family's reputation. And I knew he had a wife and family, and I wouldn't do that to him. But I didn't give a damn about that guy. And I had to get free of that resentment. And I had Bob as my sponsor at the time, and he kept talking about, you got to surrender your judgments. You got to surrender your judgments. And I couldn't figure out what he was talking about. And I kept going through the fourth column on that resentment inventory, trying to pray for him and forgive him and all that crap. And I just couldn't say I would do that, and I would come back, and I'd do that, and I'd come back. And I finally, you know, my judgments, surrendering my judgments about everything, other than sobriety, that's the toughest deal I've ever had to do. Because I have an, you know, Al-Anons have an inordinate need to be needed. Well, I have an inordinate need to be right. And I've had that all my life. I come from a long line of intelligent, arrogant, egotistical Germans, and they just, you know, we don't, surrender is not, surrender is a French word. That's not part of my vocabulary, you know? And, but, you know, I got to the point with that resentment that I was, you know, I just couldn't live within my own skin on that thing. I was going to put a bullet in my head is what was going to happen, sober. And I had to surrender my judgments about that. I had to surrender my judgments about that towards my broker. I had to surrender my judgments about that towards me. I just had to stop judging it, period. And when I finally was able to do that, I just got free of it. I mean, I'm in a spot in my sobriety today that is, I've never been. I've read about it in the promises all my sobriety. I've heard people talk about it. I mean, I'm comfortable in my own skin today. I'm happy, joyous, and free. I'm at peace with myself. I'm at peace with my maker. I'm a useful member of society. I'm a useful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor quite a few guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm right in the middle of the deal. You know, I'm the secretary of my group. We just put on our group anniversary last weekend. I'm the area treasurer for Area 63. I'm on the board for a Little Mountain conference we put together here a couple years ago. You know, I'm going to meetings all the time. I'm doing the deal. I'm in the middle of AA, and I'm back involved a little bit in politics on the fringe, doing the county party chairman thing again, not because I wanted to, but because they were in trouble and needed somebody to do it, and so I said yes, and so I'm doing that. And I'm a realtor today. I'm to the best of my ability, one day at a time, trying to be a good realtor, and I'm building some townhouses, and I'm not making a lot of money at it. I ain't getting rich at it, I'll tell you. I'm just getting by. But it's not that important for me today. And you know what? I was trying to find that external stuff that was going to make it right. And what I found is it doesn't make any difference what I do. And I just need to, God can use me, and I can be a servant to God in any situation, no matter what I'm doing. You know, I just need to focus on bringing integrity to whatever I'm doing and doing that to the best of my ability today. And that's what I'm trying to do in my job today. And it's not my real passion, but I'm trying to do the best I can and bring integrity to it. And I've got a good life today. I'm 44 and single. I never planned on that, but I'm in surrender on that too. And it's just whatever, you know. I heard a guy talk about on a tape the other day. I talked about Saint Francis, took a vow of poverty, you know, and he took a vow to be hungry, homeless, and penniless. And, you know, it's hard to get a guy in that position. You can't really get your thumb on him in any way, you know. I've discovered when I finally just been willing to surrender in every area of my life and in my career and in money and everything, just surrender and say, whatever you have in store for me, God, I don't have an agenda. I don't have an agenda. Whatever you want me to do, let's go. It's the freest I've ever been. I'm free of them old obsessions that I had for years about, you know, trying to do this and that and whatever, because I don't have an agenda today. I don't. And as a result of that, I've freer than I've ever been in my sobriety. And I'm really grateful that I've stuck it out. There's been lots of times I wanted to check out in sobriety. There's been a time or two I was really tempted to drink in my sobriety, more than several occasions. I never picked up that first drink one day at a time. I didn't put a bullet in my head during those periods of depression. And just really bad mental condition. I mean, when I was 2 years sober and going through that whole not ward thing, I clung to that second step. Because I'll tell you what, in 1987, I needed to be restored to sanity. Bad. Because I was one of those guys that was suffering from grave emotional and mental disorders. But I'm here to tell you, I haven't taken any psychiatric medication since 1988. And for the most part, I'm pretty sane, and I don't have to battle mood swings and depression and none of that crap today. I'm in a sweet spot in recovery. And I hope I have the humility to stay right-sized in Alcoholics Anonymous so I can hang on to it. Thank you.